Hey, Roger, thanks so much. Keep on rocking in the free world and doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Skate park.
Unearthing the depths of contemporary cassettes and vinyl undergrounds, ranging from DIY bedroom pop and garage rock all the way to harsh noise and, of course, drone. Pop Drone, every Wednesday at 10 to 11:30 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
My advice to young girls would be, go home after school.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 4th of July. I'm Sahar.
And I'm Marco. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5 p.m. in time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
So today's top stories and segments are segment one, our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have segment two, a report by Sahar Asaf on General Motors' mass recall of vehicles earlier in the week.
But first we have Marco's segment on science and technology.
Hello, listeners. I know you've been waiting for this story, and here it is. More news on Big Head the Psychic Turtle. Yes, Big Head is back in action, but the Brazilians are not too pleased. In his first trial, Big Head the Psychic Turtle correctly chose Brazil to defeat Croatia. But ever since, he's been choosing the opposite team. So Big Head has been retired. For all your news, all your fans of Big Head, I'm sorry to tell you, but he is now in retirement in the beach village of Praia de Forte in Brazil. In other news, cute news anyway, cute animal news, scientists have now found two locations in America where they have found tracks of a baby Stegosaurus. That's right, a baby Stegosaurus. I know we all love babies, but baby Stegosauruses, I don't know. I'll keep you updated on the findings, but these are the first two findings that the archaeologists have unearthed. One is off a highway and one is in a mountain area in Colorado. Now for some space news. I'm going to now discuss the Titan Ariel daughter craft. Yes, the Titan Ariel daughter craft. It's in the future, but it's coming. It's a big balloon that will float in between the ice giant planets, maybe in one decade's time, and the balloon will release a probe to study the atmosphere of the gas giants and to move around the surfaces if it can. So this is called an interplanetary balloon, and it could one day release a drone to explore Titan's surface. Titan is thought to have oceans and lakes of methane that are rich in hydrogen and carbon. These oceans resemble Earth's atmosphere and Earth's ocean in Earth's early stages. So scientists have named Titan's atmosphere as being prebiotic, which means it has an atmosphere and lakes and oceans that had a similar chemistry before life developed on Earth. By the way, in previous shows, many of these moons, it has been mentioned that they have more liquid on their surface and in their oceans than the Earth does, even though the Earth is much bigger. The lead researcher name is Larry Mathias, and he is from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He is the leader of the robotic and mobility group's computer vision section. Titan was first explored after visits from the spacecrafts Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 in the 1980s. These led to an accumulation of data. So the new Cassini spacecraft in 2005 probed Titan's surface and touched down on the moon. So Cassini mapped Titan with radar and it discovered liquid lakes and oceans. This is a very important project because NASA has plans for the future to explore the outer solar system. And this is and Mars, so this is very important because NASA has plans to colonize Mars, the moon, and you never know, Titan may be next. Remember the disco ball of the 1970s and 80s? Yes, the disco ball is back, but in a different way. Now we have something called disco clams. Yes, disco clams are now putting on undersea light shows in oceans around the world. These disco clams have reflective mirrors on their lips that reflect light. So scientists have now been seeing the light shows on the ocean floors. The lips are covered with tiny silica spheres that reflect natural light. Other species on the ocean floor can do the same thing by a process called bioluminescence. They release chemical energy, and when this chemical reacts with oxygen, it produces light on our ocean floor. So such animals as plankton and octopus use bioluminescence, but the disco clam has the reflective lights to put, or the reflective lips to put on a light show. So if anybody wants to go to see the disco ball or disco clams, go to your nearest ocean and see if you can see it. In other news, is he back? He might be back. Remember Arnold in the famous Terminator movie? He's famously said, "I'll be back." Now scientists are using a new form of tissue engineering to create a new Arnold or a new Terminator. Engineers are now creating robots powered by muscle tissues. This is being done in the University of Illinois at Urbana, where engineers are designing future robots. It's a 3D printed robot. I'm not sure what that means, but that's what the headline says. And it's called a BioBot. So with the muscle tissue on the robots, this gives more precise control over the robot's movement and a more dramatic range of motion. This is a simplified rectangular robot constructed from a flexible jelly-type material, and it's fit with two strips of engineered muscle tissue. This type of skeletal muscle tissue could replace conventional robot motors, and this would give the robots more flexibility to do a lot more things. Skeletal muscle tissue is what drives human movement. It covers our bones and is attached by stringy tendons. So the robot, which is called a BioBot, when it is attached with these flexible muscle tissues, it can now carry out more complex motor tasks and is capable of freer movement and more dynamic motion. The BioBot moves when given an electric shock, so it can be controlled by human. Scientists are looking to design new types of prosthetic limbs with this new technology. But for me, I do not think I'd want a BioBot in my bedroom at night, because I'd hate to wake up and have one like Arnold staring at me in the way Arnold did in his movie. So there's promise for this, but there's also, for me, trepidation. The next story, it's about Tibetans that live high in the mountains. Tibetans are known to thrive at higher altitudes than people that live at sea level, and this is due to lineage with their Neanderthal cousin. Genetic mutations from extinct humans from the Tibetan plateau help Tibetans and Sherpa now live at higher altitudes. These genetic variations have occurred as humans have spread out across the world from Africa. Tibetans live in an altitude of 2.5 miles, which is about 4 kilometers high in the mountains. So there is a 60% lower level of oxygen there. A pattern mutation in the Tibetan's gene, the specific gene is called EPAS1, influences the intake of hemoglobin, a protein that carries oxygen around the body. Tibetans only increase their hemoglobin a limited amount in the higher altitudes, and this allows them to survive. If there is too much hemoglobin in a person's body, this increases the risk of heart disease. So most people, like us in sea level, will experience an increase in hemoglobin in the mountains, but not Tibetans. But adapting to this new environment can take a long time. I believe this is promising news, because one day, as our species moves out into the solar system to live in different environments, we will have to adapt to these different environments. So news like this can help scientists prepare humans for living in outer space, in Mars, on Titan's moon, or on the moon. Now, in other space-related news, Arthur, the first hurricane of the season, is coming, and he's threatening North Carolina. The North Carolina coast is in the bullseye of Hurricane Arthur. Arthur could swamp North Carolina's coast and South Carolina's coast with several feet of water, anywhere from 3 to 5 feet water, on the 4th of July. So many communities have rescheduled 4th of July celebrations. NASA satellites and the imagery from these satellites are helping the coastal residents prepare for the arrival of Arthur. Arthur is a Category 1 hurricane, so it is a very powerful hurricane. There is a mandatory evacuation order for much of the South and North Carolina coast, and a lot of the problems is thought to be due to global warming, because global warming has allowed or has caused the rising of sea levels. So Arthur is a threat, but NASA is helping the residents adapt to this storm. Boston, the city of Boston, has also rescheduled its famous Boston Pops concert for July 3rd, which happened last night. So NASA technology is in full swing, helping the residents of our planet to adapt to weather patterns. This is Marco. You are up to date with the science and technology news of the day.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Okay, good.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kassla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason Whitebear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadi, Wendin Naganag. How Mataki was. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewiyan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people, we're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this language, as this. And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tanse, how? Wuju anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say, Ninanaskamun Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski, and that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a Kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Ninanaskamutaman Gakyogi Gwayotsiwa Taaski. Hi, hi. Thank you.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live for the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have Rohit Joseph live in studio with us. He'll be speaking to Peter Klein to follow up on last week's report on the sentencing of two Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt.
Hello, Peter. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Oh, brilliant. I'm glad that worked out. Technical difficulties were not a factor. Okay. So, Peter, I am going to just kind of give the audience a little bit of an introduction to the situation. So, on Monday, June 23rd, an Egyptian court sentenced three Al Jazeera journalists, including a Canadian citizen named Mohamed Fahmy, to 7 years in prison on terrorism-related charges. What was your gut reaction to the sentencing of Mohamed Fahmy?
Well, I'll be honest. I was really surprised. A lot of my colleagues were not surprised. I think they expected this to happen. You know, Egypt has been claiming that they wanted to overthrow a dictatorial regime and institute democracy and open government. And I thought, you know, the message that they would send to the world by convicting these journalists in such an obvious kangaroo court situation was, look, that's not what they want to do. They clearly want to have a non-democratic regime, and I didn't think that they would do it, and they did. I was shocked.
Yeah, and I think Mohamed Fahmy himself, including his family, were very shocked as well at the news. And do you have any thoughts on maybe why Fahmy and the other journalists got such a harsh sentence?
Well, you know, when they were first detained, we put out a statement from UBC School of Journalism condemning it, and then a number of journalists a couple weeks later from around the world also put out a joint statement that we signed as well condemning this. It was clearly at least one of the reasons was they wanted to send a chill through the journalism community, particularly the Egyptian journalism community. Although these journalists were working for Al Jazeera English, it was a message to the journalists. It was a message to the Muslim Brotherhood that these guys aren't you can't mess with us. And to that extent, I guess their message was heard loudly. Because I think the people realize that this regime means business. They're not going to tolerate anything. In this case, there was zero evidence. I mean, absolutely no evidence that against these guys. It's not like there was sort of like, well, maybe there was something there. Mm-hmm. Nothing there. The evidence that they showed was footage that these guys had that was completely unrelated to Egypt and completely innocuous. Horse riding, and it was ridiculous that the evidence that they put forward, and the judges wore sunglasses when they sent the sentence down. I mean, it was like, it's almost out of like a bad movie, like what a kangaroo court, like an amateur filmmaker's version of the kangaroo court would be.
Oh my!
They were shameless about it.
Which brings me, and it's good that you brought up the regime. And speaking of regime, there's been so much regime change in Egypt. Would you happen to know, like going from Hosni Mubarak to Mohamed Morsi and now Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, like within these last 3 years, such rapid change in government in Egypt, did it get worse from, you know, pre-Mubarak? Like, have we seen the situation overall degrade in terms of the treatment of journalists?
You know, I don't feel I'm in a position to comment on it because I have not been in Egypt in a decade. I haven't reported from there. I've certainly had a lot of friends report from there in the last few years. And several of my colleagues, you know, have been attacked or detained in Egypt since Mubarak was deposed. It under Mubarak, it was, you know, I've been to Egypt under Mubarak. It was not particularly difficult to be a foreign journalist. I think there were challenges being an Egyptian journalist, but even then, I think probably in some ways it was easier to work because it was a stable regime, right? And people sort of knew the rules. Whenever there's transition and when there's chaos, that's what leads to these kinds of situations. And I think the various regimes as you listed them, mm-hmm. as they've been changing over the last 3 years, are all trying to kind of figure themselves out and figure out where the envelope is that they can push. You know, governments generally don't like press. I mean, you know, you don't have to look that far. Our own country, governments often don't like the press meddling and pressuring them, and that's just the nature of journalism. I mean, we're probably doing something wrong if the government really likes us, because one of our roles as the Fourth Estate is to hold government accountable.
Of course, yeah.
And that's what we do. And so obviously a government like the Sisi regime and prior regime, they did not, they don't want governments, they don't want journalists holding them accountable. They're trying to figure out what's going on and trying to establish new regimes and oftentimes using means that they don't necessarily want brought to light.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter. And then I guess this comment has been coming up a lot. People, you'll see them comment on the news story, a journalist such as Mohamed Fahmy or anybody who's going into these politically unstable regions or tumultuous areas should realize their own risks. And basically these comments amount to, well, a journalist is responsible completely for their own safety. Now, you have a lot of experience reporting in all sorts of different environments, stable or unstable. How culpable is a journalist for their own safety? I mean, should it be reasonable that a government, their own government, should be able to protect them, at least in situations like Mohamed Fahmy's?
Well, you know, I think in this particular, you know, it's one thing if you say, look, you're embedded in a war zone, you know what you're getting into, right?
Yeah.
And if you get injured or got killed in a war zone, you know, sadly that's the cost sometimes of covering war zones. Wars are inherently unstable and bullets are flying and
mm-hmm.
they hit by bullets. That's how wars are. This was not that situation. I mean, these guys had a little hotel room, which was essentially the Al Jazeera English bureau there, and they were doing interviews with members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is certainly not unreasonable since the Muslim Brotherhood was the previous regime. Not like these guys were terrorists that they were tracking down. They were interviewing political leaders from the previous regime. That's all that they did. And that is essentially what the government is holding against them. So, I mean, I don't think that any of these guys, when they went into Egypt to do this work, were thinking they were putting themselves in particularly harm's way.
Mm.
And, you know, we certainly call on the Canadian government to condemn the detention, particularly Fahmy, since he's, as you say, a Canadian and studied here in Vancouver. I think the Canadian government is doing what it can now.
I was just about to ask you, actually. John Baird has commented that that Fahmy's dual citizenship complicates what the Canadian government can do. In the past, has that been an issue with journalists who have dual citizenship? Is what John Baird's saying quite true, that like
if you have a dual citizenship, it's going to end up being more tricky for our government to do something about it?
You know, I don't buy that. I mean, if you're a Canadian citizen, you don't pay half your taxes. You get full representation by your country. You know, you may have dual citizenship. A lot of Canadians have dual citizenship. It's perfectly legal to have dual citizenship. There's absolutely no reason that, you know, and it's not to say that other countries, you know, if you have multiple citizenship, other countries that may represent you should also intervene. But, I mean, I think we have a responsibility when Canadian journalists are in harm's way abroad. Canada has a responsibility to speak out and do whatever it can to represent them and to, you know, make sure they're safe.
Absolutely. I agree 100%, Peter. Those are wise words. And then I guess since we brought it back to Canada, we'll finish off with this last question. In Canada, is it a role model in this case? Is it a country that, or on the other hand, has room for improvement concerning freedom of press and the preservation of our journalists' rights? Are we ones to be able to talk to Egypt and say, hey, don't do this? Or to a degree, are we at fault? Because you had mentioned earlier, even at home, the government is not always a fan of the press. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly wouldn't put Canada in the camp of the Egyptian regime.
Of course,
I think for the most part, Canadian journalists can do their work unfettered. And, I mean, there's certainly room for improvement. There's been a lot of press about access to information. Is often curtailed. Access to scientific information, particularly, can be curtailed. There's still room for improvement, but I mean, for the most part, the press in this country is able to do its job fairly well. And I think it does. You know, I think there's a lot of really wonderful journalists who do some excellent work and important work. Frankly, I don't think our society could function without them.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us. Again, everybody listening in, that was Peter Klein, the director of UBC's Graduate School of Journalism. You've been an amazing guest. Thank you so much, Peter, and hope to see you maybe on the news or even better yet, educating more people about these issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break. But stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Timber Concerts and CITR present The Fresh and Onlys, with special guest The Shilohs, Friday, July 11th at the Electric Owl Social Club. It's an early show, with doors at 7 and the show at 8. Tickets are available at Red Cat Records and Zulu Records or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, go to thefreshandonlys.blogspot.ca. Catalano Street Party, Vancouver's biggest music and arts festival, is back July 12th from 11 a.m. until 9 p.m. Come on down to West 4th Avenue for over 50 great bands, including Grapes of Wrath, Ben Sinister, Humans, Lightning Dust, and a special performance by the Poppy Family, starring Susan Jacks with members of the New Pornographers, Black Mountain, and Destroyer. Over 40 tasty food carts, hundreds of Vancouver's best vendors, and the new Desjardins Family Zone will highlight the day. Catalano Street Party, Saturday, July 12th, brought to you with love by the merchants of West 4th Avenue.
On Saturday, July 5th, Cloud Nothings and Mets co-headline a show at the Rickshaw Theater with special guests The Witches.
Tickets are available in-store at Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, and High Life Records, or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, visit www.cloudnothings.com.
So I say segment two?
No.
Up next, we have a report by Seher Asaf on General Motors' mass recall of vehicles earlier in the week.
Automaker General Motors has experienced a major safety crisis. An additional 8.2 million cars have been recalled over faulty ignition switches, bringing General Motors' total number of recalls this year to more than 28 million. 3 deaths, 8 injuries, and 7 crashes involving the vehicles recalled. CEO Mary Barra said in a statement, quote, "We have worked aggressively to identify and address the major outstanding issues that could impact the safety of our customers," unquote. She also added, quote, "If any other issues came to our attention, we will act appropriately and without hesitation," unquote. The defect in question involved failing to arrange airbags in certain Chevrolet Cobalts and other models. Ignition switches on Cobalts and Saturn Ions can suddenly shut off the engine by switching out of the run position, which in turn disconnects both the power steering and the brakes, resulting in a loss of control of the vehicle. Airbags are also disabled. General Motors conceded that the switches in its vehicles are defective in February. It soon became evident that the automaker had known about it for nearly a decade. GM has acknowledged at least 54 accidents related to the issue, in which 13 people died, but victim groups claim that the true list includes many more people. The costs could go into millions or billions of dollars. Laura Christian, the mother of an accident victim, said she has evidence that 165 people have died in accidents caused by the ignition switch problem. Kevin Feinberg, assigned with the responsibility of providing compensation for victims of faulty General Motors ignition switches, said in a statement that there's no limit to what the company might pay out. In a press conference, Feinberg said he will start processing claims starting August 1st until the end of the year. He recommended everyone who thinks they were affected to participate, regardless of whether they have reached a settlement previously or not. Under Feinberg's formula, for example, relatives of a deceased 25-year-old earning $75,000 per year who is married with 2 children would get $5 million. But the relatives could craft a case to get more. Severely injured people could get more money than the dumb death cases. For instance, a 40-year-old earning $70,000 per year who is married with no children and became a paraplegic in a crash would get $6.6 million under Feinberg's plan. Some victims and safety advocates say that this is a very short time frame. Laura Christian, the birth mother of Amber Mary Rose, who was killed in a Chevy Cobalt crash in 2004, said providing proof that the ignition switch caused the death is hard for families to do in such a short time frame, especially on accidents that occur so long ago. Christian said, quote, "I wish we could go back and get a hold of the car. I wish we could go back and learn about each and every single case. But time is not on our side. It was certainly on GM's side," unquote. In a statement, GM said it supports Feinberg's plan. The company said, quote, "We are pleased that Mr. Feinberg has completed the next step with our ignition switch compensation program to help victims and their families," unquote. They also added, "We are taking responsibility for what has happened by treating them with compassion, decency, and fairness. To that end, we are looking forward to Mr. Feinberg's handling claims in a fair and expeditious manner," unquote. GM has also experienced a major fallout with its Canadian dealers. The Canadian dealers claim that they have been struggling to make a profit due to a big drop in market share and sluggish sales. A group of 17 General Motor dealers is filing a lawsuit against the company. They argue that GM did not provide them with sufficient financial support, despite receiving millions of dollars in aid from taxpayers. They say none of the $10 billion bailout provided to the company by the Canadian and Ontario governments as part of joint funding with the U.S. during the financial crisis in 2009 has been spent in Canada.
Thank you, Sahir, for that report. Up next on News 101, we have today's headlines. In local news, Granville Island may be changing hands soon. On Wednesday, several local media outlets reported on a rumor that the popular tourist attractions management would be transferred from the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, or CMHC, to Port Metro Vancouver. Mayor Gregor Robertson and City of Vancouver Member of Parliament Hedy Fry were quick to issue statements in regards to the rumored transfer. The city of Vancouver is strongly opposed to Granville Island being controlled by Port Metro Vancouver, said Mayor Robinson, calling the island, quote, one of Vancouver's most treasured places and one of the top two tourist destinations anywhere in Canada. MP Fry refused to comment on the rumors themselves, but did say that she would, quote, oppose any blatant major commercialization and privatization of the management of Granville Island. The island was redeveloped in the 1970s as an environment for food, culture, and artisans to come together and flourish. This was in line with the CMHC's mandate at the time, which was to support and improve middle-income communities. More recently, some have observed that the CMHC has drifted from this mandate and may no longer be the best body to manage Granville Island. Mayor Robertson's objections to the transfer stem from the distanced nature of Metro Vancouver's Port Authority. Like the CMHC, it's a federal body. Robertson said in a statement that, quote, local decision-making and operations are crucial to Granville Island's revitalization and continued success. Though the CMHC has stated that, quote, over the years, they have considered different options for the management of the island, they refused to confirm the rumor, adding that it is, quote, too soon to speculate on any outcome.
In national news, a Canadian woman is the first Canadian representative to ever reach a Grand Slam final. Eugenie Bouchard from Montreal has made history by being the first Canadian to ever reach the final round in the Wimbledon Tennis Championship. Canadian-born Greg Rusedki made the U.S. Open title match 17 years ago in 1997, but he was competing for Great Britain. Vancouver's Vasek Pospisil made it to the double finals, but only with the help of his American partner, Jack Sock. On the men's side, Milos Raonic played today against Roger Federer in his bid to follow Eugenie Bouchard's lead and became the first Canadian man to reach the Wimbledon final, but he unfortunately fell to Federer in three sets. Bouchard will play in the final on Saturday against Czech player Petra Kvitová, who won the title in 2011. New anti-spam legislation to save you the hassle of a full inbox. The new legislation came into effect this past Tuesday, July 1st, and requires that businesses collect oral or written consent prior to sending any emails to their Canadian customers. The public's response to the new legislation has been largely positive, with many people openly appreciative of the government's attempt to curb spam emails. However, the CRTC has already received over 1,000 complaints of violations since Tuesday. Should companies be found in violation of the new legislation, they will face a $10 million fine, while individuals in violation of the legislation could face up to $1 million in fines. The government is encouraging Canadians to forward spam messages to spam at fightspam.gc.ca or to file online complaints through their website at the same address. Once again, that's fightspam.gc.ca.
Those are your local and national headline news on CITR. We are now going to take a quick break.
This year's Girls Rock Camp Showcase takes place Saturday, July 12th at the Rio Theatre at 1 p.m. It will feature eight new bands of 8 to 17-year-old girls that formed and wrote original songs at a five-day summer camp. Girls Rock Camp is a social profit organization that works to build self-esteem in female-identified youth through music creation and performance. Tickets are $10 at Audiopile and at Red Cat Records or online at girlsrockcampvancouver.ca. This could be the funniest, cutest, and weirdest show you'll see all year.
This is
Timber Concerts and CITR present Sharon Van Etten with guest Jana Hunter Sunday, July 6th at the Rickshaw Theater. Tickets are available at Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, and High Life Records, or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, go to SharonVanEtten.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next on News 101, we're pleased to present an episode on Wings entitled Global Feminism. This series is produced by Frida Worden, and the episode was produced and hosted by Jana Juniper G. The show was originally broadcast by CFUV in Victoria.
Cynthia Enloe on how feminist activists are strengthening international solidarity through local organizing and actions.
It takes a lot of energy to be a feminist, but it also is very energizing to be a feminist.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Cynthia Enloe, a feminist writer, lecturer, and researcher, has written 14 books on national and international women's issues and has lectured around the world. She has received many awards for her work, along with honorary doctorates from the University of London, Connecticut College, and the University of Lund in Sweden. This is Jana Juniper G., with Cynthia Enloe, speaking on her work and the many ways to build on and continue nurturing a transnational feminist movement.
I'm a university professor at Clark University here in Massachusetts, and my writing and teaching is particularly about transnational feminism, about women in globalized factories, and women's experiences of militarism. Those are the three general areas that I try to keep track of and scribble about. The newest book is called Seriously, with an exclamation mark, and the subtitle is Investigating Crashes, as in banking crashes, Investigating Crashes and Crises as If Women Mattered, and it just came out this past year. When you learn things, you just want to share it, so yeah. Writing books is just a way of sharing things that you learn and you want other people to know.
How would you define feminism?
Of course, there are many ways to define feminism, but I think one of the hallmarks of trying to be a feminist is taking women seriously. That is, to actually see women's experiences and women's ideas as worth paying close attention to. And that doesn't mean that you think all women or girls are heroes, or all women or girls are necessarily oppressed, or all women or girls are angels. It means that to be a feminist, for me, means paying close attention to women and girls will make you smarter about the world, about injustices in the world, but also about how those injustices can be resisted. So that's one of the hallmarks for me of being a feminist, is to really take seriously women's lives without imagining that all women are the same, certainly, or that all women have the same lack of privilege or the same kind of opportunities, but to take them seriously as a way of making sense of how the world works. The other thing about being a feminist, I think, is being interested in and intolerant of differences in power, unequal power, and unequal rights. To be a feminist does mean, then, that you are political in the broadest, deepest sense of being political, but you're political for the sake of understanding injustice and trying to achieve justice and justice is something that's very, very difficult to understand. And so to be a feminist means you keep thinking about it, and you think about the ways in which you yourself are complicit, perhaps, in some kinds of injustice. And nobody's born a feminist. You have to learn how to be one. Mm-hmm. And you never are fully one. You're always, every day, trying to be a feminist. You have to constantly remind yourself you have to be curious about things you thought you didn't have to be curious about.
You are listening to Wings. And here's more from Cynthia Enloe.
One of the warnings, I think, that many feminists around the world are giving us these days is don't lump all quote-unquote Western women together, since Western women differ by their position in the racial hierarchies that are created unfairly, in the class economic hierarchies, but also we shouldn't lump together all women from even Indonesia or from Mexico or from Japan. Women are really diverse within countries as well, and globalization will have an impact on their lives that's really diverse. It means we have to be much more subtle and much more curious and much more energetic when we now think of which women in which countries at which moment are being disadvantaged because their farm products don't sell anymore or because they are working in unsafe factories, and which women are gaining new opportunities and not necessarily conscious of what those new globalized job opportunities are doing to women that they live just across the town from. The women in the countries where international capital and international export corporations have made the biggest interventions, they are the ones who really are teaching us how to be smart. So Chinese feminists, Hong Kong feminists, Indonesian feminists, Filipino feminists, Mexican, Nicaraguan, Colombian feminists, they're the ones really who can teach us how to pay attention both to the gender politics of their own local elites and the gender politics of foreign government elites and corporate decision makers. You have to watch all of them and their interactions with each other, especially when they go out drinking together, which they do. A lot of business is carried on in all-male drinking clubs.
When we look at international efforts to include more women in governments and decision-making bodies like banks and corporate offices, do you see other ways besides quotas and political party lists and constitutional reform that will continue to strengthen the indigenous women's places in these systems of power that have been primarily male-dominated up to now and even now?
Well, I think, first of all, the quotas and the lists, those really are important, and they're not very widely used. So the EU, for instance, just voted down, the EU Commission, European Union Commission in Brussels, just voted down a very strong proposal to use the Norwegian corporate board quota system for women. Just voted it down as an EU standard. So we shouldn't imagine that corporate board gender quotas or party nomination list gender quotas are widely in use. They are being used more than they were, say, 30 years ago, that's for sure. But we shouldn't imagine, oh, that's old hat. People are already using that. It works or it doesn't work or it barely works. Because, in fact, we scarcely know if it works. But you're right in thinking we've got to really have a really diverse, multi-tool toolbox to try and think about how to lessen the masculinization, particularly amongst privileged men. And in society, in different societies, who is a privileged man is going to differ. Because, you know, Sri Lanka is ethnically diverse, and Indonesia is ethnically diverse, and Mexico is ethnically diverse. So we shouldn't imagine it's just white and people of color. That's not how it works in a